Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Mike, happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Tim.
We're recording. It's the Friday of Memorial Day weekend. I looked at the weather app a couple of hours ago. It's the only nice day of the weekend here in Washington, D.C. So anyway, we've got a special topic to talk about this week. It's a topic that I've wanted to talk about for a while. I know you've wanted to talk about it since we even conceived of the podcast. And it's one that I think is going to be of great interest to our listeners. It's also super complicated and makes my head hurt. And that's quantum computing. So if you're good with it, why don't we get started?
Yeah, I think we should just dive in and sort of explain what quantum computing is. There are other quantum sciences we'll touch on briefly, but today's episode, we really want to talk about quantum computing. So the reason quantum computing is sort of cutting edge and is, I think, the next wave of supercomputers is because of the properties of quantum particles. And again, we're lawyers, we're not physicists. We can bring in a technical guest to tell more of the details, but there's enough. I think we can start it at the beginning that I hope our listeners can get a sense why a quantum computer will be exponentially faster than like today's supercomputers. So some of the basics of quantum physics that are relevant here are the superposition of quantum particles. And let me go back and explain, you know, what that means in terms of like a regular computer. I think we're all familiar with binary bits and bytes, you know, in a regular computer. That's the idea that all the bits are a one or a zero. So you got, you know, in binary, you write out, you know, essentially 1001, you know, that's actually your language at the binary level. So it's like one and zero is, you know, is also on or off, right? It's an either or position. I'm either one or I'm either zero. What we call in the quantum computing world, the things we're going to talk about are qubits. And because of the properties of superposition under quantum physics, a qubit can either be a one or a zero, or actually a one and zero at the same time. That's where everyone starts to get lost in quantum. It's sort of, you can exist in two different states simultaneously. And again, you can go down quantum physics road and talk about that, you know, in other areas, but that's why quantum computing is sort of a huge area here, because instead of having to go, I have this many bits, right, in my computer, the ones and zeros, with qubits, I have ones, I have zeros, and I have ones or zeros simultaneously. So the processing power of a quantum computer is like exponentially increased.
And so is that superpositioning in qubits, is that where the Schrodinger's cat metaphor comes from?
Yeah, that's the sort of the Schrodinger's cat thought experiment is the cat in the box is either dead or alive, but you don't actually know the answer unless you open the box, which I can also say we'll get into sort of one of the downsides of quantum computing is whenever you measure something in quantum, the act of measuring it changes its state. So that, in the concept of quantum computing, is, I think, sort of the downside. I'm going to try to get the terminology right. That is decoherence. So the quantum state is very fragile, right? Like a qubit, and this is where we're getting the challenges of quantum computing, right? It's got to be in, you know, certain temperatures, certain environments. The slightest vibration or change in temperature, anything in its environment, can cause a qubit to tumble out of superposition before its job has been done. So if what we want is a qubit in superposition, so it can be one or zero or one zero simultaneously, you've got to really keep them in this environment. So that's why, and we'll get into the details of quantum computing infrastructure, but generally it's got to be like super cool temperatures, vacuum chambers, you know, you won't want noise to creep in to your qubits, because then that causes errors to creep in. So you can deal with some of that by algorithms to compensate for how you're doing things, but adding more and more qubits also helps. So, and that's one piece I want to get into in terms of where we are today in quantum computing. This exists. Quantum computing has been done. Research has been done out there. There's a lot of tech companies that will offer time on their quantum computer, like through cloud services. So just like a researcher would, you know, go and get time on a supercomputer to do a project, you can do that today. But I think the currently the biggest quantum computer right now is IBM's Osprey, if I'm remembering right. And that has 433 qubits. But the industry has largely said, if we want to really recognize or realize, achieve, I should say, the value proposition of quantum computing, someone needs to build a 1 million qubit quantum computer. And that's when you'll sort of get into the world about now we can really crunch some big numbers. But we should talk about kind of what that, right, you know, what does quantum computing do for you, right? Like, what are the advantages?
Let's finish with one other term that I think a lot of people have heard. So I guess, so these qubits can either exist as ones or zeros or both. And then there's also the possibility of atoms or subatomic particles existing in more than one place at one time. This entanglement theory.
Yeah, so quantum entanglement is what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. And the way I've often heard about it in this space is it's relevant for quantum computing, but also the entanglement piece is also relevant for quantum communications, which we won't get into today. But the idea is I take a quantum particle and it's essentially separated. And, you know, you've got, say, one quantum particle of some kind here and one somewhere else, like a distance away. And the concept of entanglement means that, say, you know, for qubits in the quantum computing space, they're still entangled. They still exist in a single quantum state, even though, like, they are physically separated by long distances. And that's why Einstein called it spooky action as a distance, because, you know, they're separated. They're, in the normal sense of the word, they're not the same particle, if you will. But under quantum entanglement, they are still in a single quantum state. No one's really explained sort of like why that happens, as far as I'm aware, at least for the layman. But that means if I do something to the particle over here, it'll also affect the particle on the other side, wherever the distance is. And so for like quantum communications, the example there would be, look, maybe I can communicate because these particles are still connected in a quantum state, even though they're far away. I can do something to this A over here, and it will happen to be over here. But for quantum computing, you know, that's also still relevant for sort of like increasing your processing power. In the regular binary world, if I double the number of bits, it increases its processing power. But thanks to this entanglement approach, adding extra qubits to a quantum machine produces an exponential increase in its number crunching ability. So, you know, 2 to the power of 2 is 4. You know, that it's going to be an exponential increase with the more qubits you have, not just a doubling, if that makes sense. So okay. all these quantum properties mean that the more qubits I add to my quantum computer, I'm increasing my ability to process things exponentially, as opposed to regular supercomputers. You're kind of limited as to how far you can go.
Great. So now we have a little bit of a background on some of the concepts involved in quantum computing. What are sort of the national security applications for quantum computing that policymakers both are looking at, you know, sort of for offensive potential for the United States, and then also as areas of concern that adversaries may be able to exploit?
Yeah, so one thing we should sort of lay out is that quantum computing itself is, like I think many of the interesting technologies we talk about on this podcast, inherently dual use. Quantum computing is not itself a military thing, right? So it's, you could use a quantum computer for things like, this is probably the most well-known example, trying to crack an adversary's encryption methods, because a quantum computer will move a lot faster than, you know, a regular computer. But I can also use it to do things like do climate and weather modeling, complex chemical formulas in the pharmaceutical or chemical space. I think there's also benefits to, you know, car manufacturing, things like that. It's just, there's all these great things you can do that today supercomputers probably need to do. And the promise of quantum computing is it's going to be even faster than today's biggest supercomputer to do these things. Now, military application stuff would be great. What do I need supercomputers for in the national security and military world? As I said, one of it is to try to break the adversary's encryption. Could also be for nuclear weapons or ballistic missile modeling type things. Like, the idea is just do things faster. Another one, which we just had our AI episode a while back, is the AI processing that we talked about on our episode with Scott. You could exponentially increase your ability to teach an AI model if you're using a quantum computer as opposed to a supercomputer. So everything we talked about in our AI episode, picture that going much, much faster because you have a quantum computer.
So let's get back to the encryption piece here for a second, because I think that's the one that policymakers are most concerned about. In March of 2022, the administration released National Security Memorandum 10, I believe, which sort of laid out a roadmap, if you will, at least for the national security agencies of the government, to start thinking about a post-quantum world. And can you sort of walk through that a little bit for us?
Yeah. So the National Security Memorandum, as I recall, is about promoting U.S. leadership in quantum computing. Well, this is the full title, I guess. Mitigating risks to vulnerable cryptographic systems. So it's the double-edged sword we always get in the encryption world, right? Where the U.S. would like to continue to be a leader in quantum computing, but recognizing the better, faster supercomputer you make out there in the world means you could then break encryption and your adversaries could then break your encryption. So we could have a whole session just on encryption, but as I recall, our current U.S. IT systems are using the advanced encryption standard. I believe key lengths go up to 258 bits. So if an attacker wants to break data encrypted by one of these advanced encryption standard keys, you've got to sort of go through guessing every possible combination of the key. That's a number crunching function that a supercomputer has to do. It's not something humans do. I mean, this is, we're far beyond trying to crack encryption methods done by humans, before the world wars. You need to have computers try to crack encryption keys. There's, other ways that you can reduce sort of how long it's going to take, depending on sort of the algorithms you use with your computer. But for quantum computing, again, because of the advantages they have of superposition and entanglement to sort of speed up operations, it will reduce time to try to crack an adversary's encryption. So again, current quantum computers are not doing that. I mean, we've not heard, at least publicly, that some of these 100, 200, or the 433 qubit IBM computer are being used to try to crack encryption modules. But the 1 million qubit quantum computer that someone will eventually develop, it's exactly the sort of complicated mathematical process that computer can do, is trying to break these encryption keys. But again, it's because you got to go through all these various possibilities. So I think that's one of the major risks, I think, that the National Security Memorandum 10 is talking about, is while the U.S. government is also interested in developing, quantum computing technology, at the same time, NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, has a program to develop the next encryption standard that hopefully will be quantum computing resistant. So we're all looking ahead to assume someone's going to make this computer that can break today's encryption standards faster. How do you protect against that? So quantum resistant cryptography is now sort of the buzzword of the day. And to go to the breaking of it, I think I've seen different estimates that some folks have said it's not in the near future that a quantum computer will be built that could break, the current cryptography, or even maybe the next generation cryptography that's in mind. But others have said, by 2030, maybe. I mean, that's not that far off. 2040, a little further out, but it's not outside the realm of possibility here. So the National Security Memorandum talking about let's get quantum resistant cryptography started now, it takes time. Like it's in a way, maybe it is a little behind the curve to start talking about that now. Research should have been done maybe earlier.
Maybe it should have been, but actually for the government, this is actually fairly well to the left of boom, in the current climate. So this is sort of a problem that's akin to maybe like a Y2K on steroids, if you will. One of the things that I'm aware of is that adversaries, the Chinese, the Russians, and others, have been harvesting American encrypted communications with the hope that one day they will be able to unlock them and to gain sort of a fuller understanding of what will then be contemporary American policy by looking at sort of, discussions that were held 10, 15, 20 years prior. And so that's one issue that, is already existent out there. Are there other areas where you think sort of in the intelligence and national security realm where quantum computing is going to make a big difference?
I mean, I think anything you can think of that a supercomputer is being tasked to do today is something that you can task a quantum computer to do. And you can give some examples of like AI, and modeling for weapon systems or nuclear weapons. Those are key national security projects. It takes time to do those, even on today's supercomputers. I think anything that you can think of the national security realm that requires extensive processing power is ripe for using a quantum computer to do the operations. And again, if the idea is to, you know, get faster than your adversaries, that's the promise of quantum computing. So any problem set that, I mean, even as a practical matter, let's, you know, think of the supercomputers today, like you got to get time on the computer, right? It's not, there are not an infinite amount of supercomputers at Department of Energy labs or DOD or other places or at NSA that are constantly doing things. You know, they need to be replaced. They run down. It's time to build the next computer. You know, the promise with quantum computing would be, I think this is where this is probably going to go, is you'll get, someone will build the $1 million qubit quantum computer and probably let people use it on a cloud basis, right? So like, I don't have to go into a DOE lab, you know, and use the big room. Oh, and I should also, let's point that out too, right? Like when I say a million qubit quantum computer, it's probably going to have to be physically the size of some of our older supercomputers. There is, as far as I understand it, no one's expecting, right, that a quantum computer will one day be a new desktop. Now, everyone said that about computers back in the day, right? That these will never be shrunk down to the size of home use. They totally were, thanks to, you know, Bill Gates and Dell and everyone else, right? But for quantum, probably not, at least within our lifetimes. They're going to have to be, it's a building, it's going to require, you know, concrete, silicon, optics, depending on how you're doing this. I mentioned, you know, temperatures, you know, a lot of the current quantum computers being tested out there have to be at temperatures of deep space. So we're talking like that. That's a huge investment right there. You need
very close to absolute zero. I believe.
So you need these sort of cryo systems. You need, you know, helium. So all the stuff has to be built. So again, sort of going to how this would be done is whoever builds that would then, you know, offer people to, you know, government agencies or whoever it's going to be. If it's commercial industry, like I said, the chemical sector, life sciences, even automotive, time on my quantum computer, right? So we'll sell this on a cloud services type basis. You can do stuff on that. But again, unlike the supercomputers of today that were government funded have been built, we in the United States do not currently have the 100 million qubit supercomputer project. It doesn't exist yet. So is industry going to build this? Is the government going to fund it? Or, and this gets to sort of some of our bigger, you know, sort of global competition points, is some other country going to build the 100 million qubit supercomputer first?
All right. You keep asking that question, Mike Scheimer, so you're clearly dying to answer it, or at least discuss it. So who else is in this game? You know, clearly, I think the price of entry's got to be pretty high, just in terms of money and infrastructure. So who's in the race?
Yeah, so actually, quantum computing as a general concept has been around for a while. So there are actually a lot of players in the space, probably more than some folks would have thought. Australia is pretty far along, as I understand it. So again, going back to our AUKUS episode, there's an opportunity here that, you know, maybe the U.S. could cooperate with Australia on the first 100 million qubit quantum computer being built. There's a number of countries in Europe that are pretty far ahead as well. Japan, I think, is also pretty far along on this. And of course, China is pretty far along. Though my understanding is that kind of the lead in quantum science that China has right now, which isn't really the topic we have for today, is on the quantum communication side, which is where you and I've talked about separately, sort of the ability to have secure communications using the principles we talked about of entanglement and superposition. They're actually pretty far ahead of that. There's actually a network, I think, that they've publicly said has already been built on that. That sort of research does tie in, though, to like building a quantum supercomputer. So they are fairly well along as well.
One other thing, you know, you've talked a little bit about AI, and one of the promises of AI, of course, is, you know, real true autonomy. And one of the things that I've been reading a little bit about is the role of quantum sensing. Is that something that you're at all familiar with? Sort of the timekeeping and the ability to sense changes in gravity and, you know, and other sort of physical manifestations that can be actually done separate and apart from any connectivity to GPS or any kind of other home.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think we should mention, I think the big quantum areas currently are quantum computing we've been talking about today, quantum communications, we just touched on. I think China's actually probably got a bit of a lead on that. And then quantum sensing is, I believe, probably one of the quantum sciences that's the furthest along. Like, it can be deployable. You can use quantum sensors in ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. I've heard it said that, similar to the way you just described it, that, you know, the way these sensors can pick things up, quantum sensing could lead to improvements in submarine detection. So
that's my understanding as well, that it could actually kind of revolutionize ASW detection and make a lot of submariners very unhappy.
Right. So take that, like all the cryptographers of the world, right? We feel good about our current encryption method, or this is how we've been breaking them, if we're the NSA or others. Quantum computing is going to set up a whole new paradigm on, well, and quantum communications, as we said too, on both secure communications and trying to break those communications. Sensing, same approach, right? Like, things that we thought otherwise may not have been, you know, as easy to detect, quantum sciences and quantum technology can be used in that aspect. And like, submarines is one of the great examples. I think there's even, I've heard things like detecting underground structures or the existence of nuclear materials because of the high sensitivity of quantum sensing. That's been a challenge, you know, globally for years. Is someone hiding nuclear materials in a certain location, you know, but you're not able to find it through usual detection techniques. So quantum sensing is pretty far along.
So, you know, we spend, if you go on to like 38 North or some of these other websites that follow the North Korean or Iranian nuclear program, you're looking at these commercial satellite images where they're trying to discern whether tunnel entrances have changed. And my understanding is that the quantum sensing, you know, essentially gives you a much more definitive picture as to whether or not something's changing underground.
So we like to think of it as both the promises and perils of quantum sciences and quantum technology. You know, huge advantages both in commercial and military uses, but also because of what this is all about, these can crack and break, you know, and detect things that previously folks thought were secure. It cuts both ways, right? It's agnostic. It depends on how you want to use it. Kind of like we talked about AI the other week.
So let's take it back to the realm of the practical here for our clients. We have clients in every possible field of human endeavor here at Ogun Lovells. A lot of pharmaceutical clients, a lot of clients in high tech, aerospace and defense. You know, should they be starting the process now within their own companies of looking towards a post-quantum future?
Yeah, I think even when you just say post-quantum future, the first thing I think of is encryption, right? So separate from the advantages you can get from modeling and simulation and using a quantum computer, I think all companies, sort of from a cybersecurity standpoint, should be paying attention to like the NIST program for the post-quantum world. As you know, we've keeping up with the latest best cybersecurity practices in the US and other places is a constantly evolving game. The post-quantum world, when it comes to encryption, is going to be completely different. So, you know, again, as a company, no matter what industry you're in, you should be aware that today's current encryption standards are 7 years, 10 years, it might take a while, or it might be faster, going to be obsolete probably. So that's a change. That's a big one. Then the positive sort of benefits that you can then reap of quantum computing is being mindful of the possibilities of what you could use quantum computing for. I mean, it's, as I said, we said there's a lot of countries that are in this space. Someone's going to build, and folks are continuing to build now, more qubits, get past the 433 level that IBM has now. Someone's going to build that quantum supercomputer. But even today, you can get runtime, if you will, on these other entities. I think Google and IBM and Amazon and some universities offer the ability to use quantum computing. It's a great opportunity. You know, I think companies, no matter what field they're in, should keep an eye out for, do we have a problem set that we could have a quantum computer look at? It's going to be a while till there's that big 100 million qubit quantum computer out there that sort of defeats all others, but it's happening. So everyone should keep an eye out for that. I would also say maybe another angle on that too is the supply chain for the quantum computing world. This gets back to our discussions on semiconductors and chips manufacturing. And as I just mentioned, you know, we're talking deep space level temperatures. You know, there's similar to our critical minerals podcast too, right? Like there's not a definite guaranteed supply chain for this. Let's talk about, you know, like the US, for example. Everything you need to build the next big quantum supercomputer is probably not going to be able to be domestically sourced. So if you're in this supply chain, you know, this is something to be mindful of. Are, you know, who are we going to supply? Is there an opportunity to, you know, support a company that's doing this for U.S. government contractors, U.S. government, you know, themselves? It's time to consider, just like all our other topics, do you need to have stronger supply chains with allies if you're going to go down this road? Like, we don't want to get to the place where someone's finally close to building this quantum supercomputer and you find out that a lot of the vital materials to keep it up and running are just like our critical minerals episode, right? In the hands of an adversary or something like that. So building the next computer, but also supporting it and building more computers will be, you know, a huge boon, I think, to the supply chain worldwide. You got to provide all this stuff. And there's a lot that you need. You're going to have to, like I said, you have to build a big initial, you know, supercomputer here. Maybe over time, quantum computers will shrink down even further, but that's a question for the quantum scientists, not me.
That's a lot to think about, Mike. I mean, I guess we'll have to leave it there for this episode and look forward to seeing you next time.
Yeah, have a good weekend. We'll come back to this topic, I'm sure, and there'll be all sorts of other, you know, technologies related to quantum that I'm sure are going to come up. So everyone, have a good weekend.
All right, take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.